it's the best of Radio Free Thinker. Today, we're going to revisit some of the best bits from past episodes. This week, The Fairness of Transit, Narconon, Scientology and Drugs, and Jane the Ripper. Let's begin the best of 160s.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
So, Don, let's discuss
something.
Translinking?
Yeah, something. The fairness of SkyTrain. Ooh, double entendre.
That's
is it double entendre?
No, I don't think so. I think
it has to be sexual. Pun. That's the word.
Yeah.
So we're going to sort of talk about SkyTrain, you know, social service versus freeloader heaven. Okay, I should explain why I thought this was a topic for our show. I have been having an on-again, off-again discussion / debate with a number of my friends about the way I feel vilified by Translink. Most of these discussions have been heated, but hollow. By hollow, I mean relying on sort of anecdotal evidence, vague impressions, you know, about authority and the absence of, well, really the absence of any hard information. So I thought I would attempt to rectify my ignorance, and I suspect a number of our listeners' ignorance, about this issue by just seeing what is going on with Translink and the so-called fair thievery.
Well, just so listeners who don't know, Translink is the sort of overruling organization in Vancouver that controls all of our transit. It's, I guess, sort of, what would you call it? Like part Crown Corporation, part private industry?
Well, it's one of those weird things, and I didn't want to go down this track because this is another rant I can do, but I'll try and keep this brief. This is one of those private-public sort of partnerships. So the buses and all that are, I believe, sort of rented or owned, semi-owned by the city, the GVRD. But the management of it is a private corporation, the Mountain Transit. I can't remember, the West Coast Transit Mountain Authority or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's governed by a board of governors, which are public employees. Some of them are mayors, some of them are elected. So it's kind of this sort of weird mishmash of private and public entities, which adds, I think, to a lot of the unclearness as to where money goes and how it goes, because it's a public operated system, but it's kind of privately owned or some variation of that.
I mean, the reason I mention it is because a lot of cities don't have that system. Like I know, like Los Angeles, for example, has competing bus companies that have different routes, rates, all that kind of stuff as well. So Vancouver's a bit unique in that respect.
Well, but unique in the world, but not unique in Canada. I think almost every mass transit system in Canada is actually publicly owned, with some exceptions where you got this sort of private public partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And to add to your explanation for those people who are not in the GVRD, which is the sort of lower mainland of Vancouver, Greater Vancouver Regional District.
Sure.
And the idea of SkyTrain, for those who don't know, it's essentially our subway. Some of the subways are above ground, some are the below ground. Because they're above ground, we call them the SkyTrain. It was a big expo thing back when you guys had expo. I wasn't in Vancouver at that time. But like I say, what I'm going to sort of deal around here is the whole idea of fair theft. And yes, there's a double meaning in that one as well. There's been a lot of changes to our regional mass transit system. Due, of course, to some criminal instances on SkyTrain, there was the introduction of the transit police complete with handguns. And this was done, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. I think 2005 or thereabouts is when it came in.
Yep.
This was ostensibly to make the transit system safer for passengers because there would be a dedicated security force to protect the ridership. Now, it is true there have been some horrific crimes in the past, but in 2009, they responded to about 28,000 incidences, which is, I mean, quite a lot. However, if you factor in that 25,000 of those 28 instances are crimes, were actually fare evasions, it seems, well, I mean, really? They spend most of their time checking tickets. Of all the other other crimes, less than half of them, granted a noteworthy number of them, were for violent crimes, although most of these were theft. The Transit Police came under fire this year after it was revealed that they were expected to issue at least 8 violation tickets per shift as part of their reasonable performance measure. Now, of course, the transit system itself accounts for anywhere from about 20 to 40 million, depending on the accountant that you use. So let's assume the lower number of about 21 million, which is the most consistent I found. And let's assume each one of them catches their quota of 8, and that in turn discourages, let's say, 10 times that number, just to do a fudge factor there. So there are 161 officers. So you do the math, carry the one, yada, yada. So they recoup, or save, depending on how you have this, for TransLink, less than about $50,000 a month, plus or minus a bit, depending on how their shifts work out. So let's take the shifts into account. So let's add another fudge factor of an incomplete order of magnitude, right? So let's say they actually managed to recoup $5 million in a year. So now that works out to be a net loss of $15 million a year for these particular officers. In a year where the TransLink itself says it has a $45 million shortfall on the horizon. I mean, does that make any sense to you, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it doesn't make sense in the terms of stopping fare evasion, but I mean, how do you put a price on preventing someone from getting, like, you know, pushed down a flight of stairs or pushed in front of the SkyTrain or, you know, robbed or raped or something like that, you know, when it's dark out and they're using the SkyTrain?
That is an excellent and very valid point. And I don't think I would have any huge issue with the whole transit cops in themselves if that's what they were doing. If they were patrolling to stop real crimes, then I'd say great. Because, I mean, I'm not saying there's no need for any kind of security on the mass transit system. I think there's a case to be made about what degree you have on it. But, yes, there are crimes done. But how are they stopping someone being pushed down a flight of stairs when they're being distracted by checking to see whether you have an up-to-date fare pass or not? Mm-hmm. So again, I agree with you at one point, but I think you actually reinforce the point that I'm making, that it seems to be a bit of a misdirection of their efforts. Now, of course, we all noticed that in the lead-up to the Olympic Games, we had the green shirts, as I like to call them, appear at the SkyTrain stations, which were, of course, intended to help tourists navigate the system. We also noticed that with the assistance of transit cops, it seemed like actually their primary duty was to ensure that no one committed the immortal sin of hitching a free ride. In the infinite wisdom of our rulers, they've decided to add turnstiles or fare gates to all SkyTrain stations. The project, which is currently underway, will cost the fare payers and the taxpayers, because most of the money is actually coming from the provincial and federal governments, it will cost us about $171 million, not including upkeep. The gates are intended to be up and running about next year sometime, and are estimated to save/recoup TransLink about $7 million in, quote, lost fares. So let's just pause for an effect there. Maybe you missed that. So they're spending $171 million to save $7 million. Now, I'm not great at math, but that doesn't seem to be an effective use of money. So let's assume they get the return they're expected, but I mean, this is quite unlikely. There have been turnstiles in other countries like London and other cities, and usually the amount they expect to reduce in truancy ridership is actually about half of what they're actually expecting to get here. So you'd actually expect about 3.5. But let's be optimistic, and let's use $171 million cost and $7 million in reduced truancy. We can expect the system to pay for itself in 25 years. And that's assuming the system will not need to be replaced due to, you know, age before that date. This strikes me as a bit of a classic case of being penny wise but pound foolish. TransLink also claims it will make the station safer because, as we know, criminals are allergic to turnstiles. Okay, It may keep out some vagrants out of the stations. It's never quite been a problem when I ride, and I ride quite often, and I pay all the time. And perhaps it will prove to be impossible for the very drunk to actually navigate through a turnstile. I mean, you have seen on occasion the really drunk person on a bus or on a SkyTrain who, frankly, is annoying and glad if they couldn't quite make it on there, although having them walk the streets may not be the safest thing in the world, but that's a whole other issue. But for the other kind of criminals that we're talking about here, so like, you know, the drug dealers, which are a large presence in our city, or the petty criminals, you know, the thieves and all that, $250 for a fare is just a minor cost of doing business. Of course, the big foolish assumption is that the people who don't pay can pay but choose not to. And it seems like our rulers totally assume that the people out there are morally evil, that they are just out to rip off the system, and they're doing it almost out of malicious intent. Well, the truth is, a notable number of the fare cheats are the homeless and the working poor, who literally cannot pay the fare, but often still need to use the transit system to get around. I mean, am I wrong?
Well, I would hazard a guess that's true. Has there been any studies or documentation to show that the majority of fare evaders are people who are lower income people who can't afford fare?
Yes.
Yes, good.
Anecdotal evidence.
Oh.
Well, actually, no. So I'm gonna actually flip that around. And because I will agree that from the evidence I've seen, and I've seen some people who've slipped on without, right? And almost all of them appear to be at least homeless. Now, of course, you can't tell of the more affluent whether they have slipped on or not for SkyTrain. But the TransLink itself just refers to them as fare evaders. And they don't actually say, well, hey, this person, you know, could have afforded to but didn't. Because they don't, I mean, when they grab you to say, hey, you don't have a ticket, they don't sit there and ask for your social economic standpoint. And actually, again, anecdotal, so we have to bear this with an extreme grain of salt. The ones that seem to be pegged out the most are youth, students who don't look like they have, that look radical, you know, the ones with the weird hairdos or the skateboards. A lot of sort of like Chinese student types I've seen pulled over. Rarely do people like me seem to get pulled aside, right? They sort of kind of give me a bit of a pass and woohoo, great to be white in our society.
Mm-hmm.
But it appears that the people who are availing themselves through this free service are those who literally just can't afford it. I mean, most people, and this is one of those arguments where they have the tragedy of the commons, there is a lot of people who believe that people will always try and rip off the system if they can get away with it. But science, study after study shows that people have a strong sense of social responsibility. I mean, I know I do, that if I have the opportunity and I can afford to pay my social things, I will do it. Because I know in the end, it benefits me, and it's the right thing to do. And most people do believe in doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, along the lines of sort of the, you know, anecdotal experiences, there's been a couple times when I've been, you know, taking the bus somewhere, and I'll notice someone who visibly looks poor. They have the obvious cues up. And they'll get on the bus, and the bus driver will say, oh, hey, Frank, because, you know, they see these guys, and they say, oh, you know, come on, Frank, just get on the bus. Just sit down, it's okay. You can't do that on the SkyTrain, though. There's no driver to have a relationship with. So I wonder if there is a certain percentage. I mean, I assume the TransLink knows that happens. Like, they must know that happens a fair bit. But, you know, they can't. When they have turnstiles on and you know, the enforcement on the SkyTrain, it seems to me that the SkyTrain is not seen as the same kind of community service as the bus system is seen by. Like, I see the SkyTrain more as sort of like, it's like the first class of transit almost. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, see, that's one of the funny things. I almost see it in a reverse. Not so much that I don't think the SkyTrain seems classier than a bus, because it does in many ways, right? But one of the things I love about this city and moving to this city that just was the idea that I can go from one city to another on a mass transit rapidly and quickly. I mean, where I come from in Brandon, right? You can go from Brandon to roughly Winnipeg, but you got to have a car or a truck or you got to catch great. And it's a huge ordeal. But I can go from West Vancouver to Langley, all in public transit, relatively fast for things. And it somehow makes this large, sprawling mass accessible to someone like me who doesn't want a car and probably couldn't afford one even if he did have one.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I find that mass transit, especially SkyTrain, because it is so quick, it does join up so many things so much more efficiently, is actually of more use to the less affluent because it allows them to so much more increase their radius. So if you're looking for a job, for example, and you're the working poor, you're not limited to just lower Vancouver or to Burnaby. You can literally get a job in Richmond, and it's a bit of a pain, but it expands your horizons to such a large degree. Now, of course, that being said, there is an issue that needs to be dealt with, but I don't think that this sort of fare grabbing is the most effective way to do it. As I had mentioned earlier, TransLink is expected to have a budget shortfall of about $45 million in 2013. A significant amount of that is to pay for increased services, notably a rapid bus service for Surrey, Langley, and Cloverdale, a bus along the Portman Bridge, which was just recently upgraded, I believe. And there was supposed to be an additional 600,000 hours of transit service across the Lower Mainland. And trust me, for someone like me, this increased service can sometimes mean the difference between getting to a job on time or being late. And if you're late too many times, you get fired. The number 10 bus, it is so horrific as far as the number of times it seems to be late. And then you get these sort of three buses in a row syndrome.
Vancouver's a growing city, and our transit needs are constantly expanding. I mean, there's been discussion for the past, 5 years about putting in another SkyTrain or rapid rail line going from, UBC out to Burnaby. So, I mean, there's lots of projects that are on the table. Right?
Well, and let's not forget the Evergreen Line, which is supposed to hook up Coquitlam, which we don't think about. I mean, I think UBC has it just for the mass number of people. But UBC is well connected to the transit system. But as I say, this idea of shrinking the GVRD so that it's accessible to everyone, a line to Coquitlam adds a whole north eastern part of the Lower Mainland open to people. And of course, that brings us, to say, well, let's remember why we have mass transit in the first place. The original idea, of course, is that a significant number of people, as they mentioned, can't afford to get around the city any other way. I mean, they can't afford a car. I mean, not only is it expensive to buy a car, but you have to license it, insure it, maintain it, not to mention the cost of gas. Mass transit provides a cost-effective way for the middle class and the working poor to have mobility and to get to their job. Of course, another reason that mass transit exists is its efficiency, which can be measured in at least three ways that I can think of. First, there are fewer cars on the road, meaning less traffic. For those who think traffic is bad now, imagine an additional 100 to 200,000 more people on the road in their own cars. And from the stats I read, SkyTrain alone has about 100 to 200,000, depending on, again, when the study was done, ridership every year. And that's not including the buses. Imagine if all those people had taken to the road. You think congestion is bad now. It's efficient also environmentally because, I mean, we have a hybrid system right now. Some of them are electric. Some of them are fossil-fueled buses. But even if they were all diesel-fueled, it produces a lot less pollutants, I mean, including things like CO2 and all that, which are emitted. There are a few particles released in the air, which are, irritants to people who have allergy or asthma. There's less smog, and it's just easier to breathe with less cars on the road producing less pollution. It's also efficient for when we do sort of wise up as a civilization and go completely carbon free, because it's going to be a lot easier to replace 1,000 buses than it's going to be to replace 1 million cars. Now, TransLink does need funding. We could jail people attempting to sneak in a ride, but ultimately, as we've already discussed, that costs more than it seems to gain. We could raise fares. However, that would only sort of serve to lower the ridership, thus lowering the revenues, and you start this sort of downward spiral that eventually allow the system to sort of wither away. Now, there have been some wise suggestions, though. There could be a relatively small levy applied to every vehicle sold in GVRD. This alone could raise upward of $30 million a year. A minor increase in property taxes, about 1% to 3%, would be enough to fund the system. For a property, just to give you an example how much that would cost you, for a property worth about $80,000, that would be only about $50 a year. And if your house is worth half that, $25 a year. There could also be a small surcharge on gasoline, which would not only help TransLink budget, but also encourage more ridership and also reduce our CO2 footprint. As little as a 2% increase on the gas taxes would only cost people about $2 a tank fill, but would cover, like I say, the increase that they need to improve the service. I guess ultimately, my point is it's a little petty, I admit, but I hate feeling like a potential criminal every time I take SkyTrain. Of all the great injustices that occur in our great city, fare jumpers do not seem to warrant a dedicated security force. It does not warrant implementing a police state. What it does is sort of distract us from what I think is the real issue regarding public transit, that it needs to be expanded, access needs to be increased, and it needs to have adequate and reliable funding provided by society. Vilifying the ridership over pennies missed that will not garner the real money needed by the system to keep it going, the money it deserves.
Well, you know, Don, if you're tired of feeling like a criminal every time you take the SkyTrain, then you just have to back Sam Harris about racial profiling, and then you can fly everywhere.
Well, as I say, I sometimes think I get a free ride, no pun intended, or maybe I guess I did mean that.
Well, depends on if you are getting a free ride or not.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like the sort of presumption of guilt we have, right? I mean, you know, we become so much more of a security nation, so much more of let's assume people are guilty, and that will somehow save society, even though when almost every empirical evidence sort of shows the reverse of that. And it makes life in the city, I mean, it's one of the great distractors. I don't like taking SkyTrain now whenever I see the cops up there. I should not be afraid of the cops. They are there to make life safer for all of us. But by having them do this extra role of being sort of instant judge and jury enforcer of petty little things, they can't really do their duty. I mean, how eager am I going to be to run to a cop saying, hey, I think that person over there looks suspicious, when the first thought in my mind is going to be, oh, I better check his fare ticket and that's okay, as opposed to, well, maybe this person really is dangerous and I should be looking after him. It puts them in the wrong moral space for them to really effectively do their job.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also is a good lesson on how these conversations happen in the public sphere. I mean, the discussion over having like a property tax levy to pay for transit expansion, and the conversation typically goes, well, why should I pay for the transit expansion? It's like, okay, do you want to pay for $171 million of turnstiles put into transit? Well, no. Well, then take the levy, you dummy. I mean, like, there's really very little skeptical scrutiny or critical inquiry into any of these questions that happens in any kind of public dialogue about this. And it's a real shame because, you know, investing in transportation, it's always a good investment.
And there have been actually quite a number of studies have bared that out, that the greater the infrastructure is for public transit, the more affordable and accessible it is to people, the better it is for the city, not only in quality of life, but also in economic returns. Because again, let's talk about that property owner. I mean, how much is your value of your property going to be when your street next to you gets widened to three lanes to accommodate traffic that's going to include gas guzzling, belching sort of cars? How much more is your property value going to increase when you have a form of rapid transit nearby that makes your property accessible to the entire Lower Mainland? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there are so many more benefits to this than there are detriments.
Well, and also just pure bragging rights. I mean, Vancouverites love to brag about our city, and having a fast, reliable transit system is one of the best things to brag about. I mean, I was in London a couple of years ago, and people complained about the tube system, but honestly, it is a fast, efficient transit system. You know, the way that it's built serves that metropolis so well. And I've often thought that, you know, Vancouver's transit lines are very strangely laid out, whereas London has these like circles going outwards, and it's just fantastic. So, I mean, having a really good transit system that we invest our time and energy into, I mean, it is worth the cost because we get to say, ha ha, our city is so much better than yours. And you know, so much fun.
Well, no, and it also goes to the thing, too, that because we have it, people tend to not think of it as a good thing. It's like, well, it's sure, I have SkyTrain, but I mean, it could be better. It does, you know, there is this stinky guy on the SkyTrain. Boy, it would be better if they didn't. You don't appreciate what it would be like if it wasn't there at all. And that, I think, is missed. It's kind of like people who sit there and they live at home and they say, oh, it's so horrible here. And then they move out and realize all the stuff that mom used to do for you. By the way, belated Happy Mother's Day. That mom used to do for you, or your parents used to, you know, they you had free cable. Well, you move out. Suddenly you got to pay for the cable and you realize, shit, this costs money.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so many times we don't appreciate what we have and we just tend to criticize it. And that's never a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, which is a lesson to appreciate us while we're on the air.
So, recently in the news, there was a story about a mother's anguish after having left her drug-addicted son at what she thought was a reputable private drug treatment center, but later discovered otherwise. The center, the Narconon Drug Prevention and Rehabilitation Center in Trois-Rivières, received $10,000 for initial treatment. However, after only 6 days, the center put her son back on a bus to Toronto. He was addicted, he was penniless, and he was essentially on the street. They claimed he was too psychotic for them to deal with. Now, granted, while he was there, he cut himself several times. He wolfed down a bottle of rubbing alcohol because, again, he was addicted. But I thought it was kind of interesting that they said for psychotic reasons, because I thought one of the tenets of Scientology was they didn't believe in psychosis or anything like that. It's all thetans that cause your thing, and you shouldn't use drugs to treat psychotic behavior.
Right, and just so everyone is on the same page, this woman took her son to this place. She didn't realize it was a front for Scientology, right?
Essentially, yes. Well, we can go more into that a little later as to why she did there, because I think that's ultimately part of the heart of the story.
Okay.
But yeah, she was desperate to find some place to take her son. This was one place that would take her, take mm-hmm. him, and so she took him there.
I see.
Since the incidents came to light, the attempts by the center to gain accreditation has failed. So, according to news reports, it's now closed its doors. It has been actually operating under provisional credentials and sort of previous lax laws. Essentially, you could set up a center and you didn't actually have to get licensing until quite recently. And even then, you were sort of allowed to run for like 4 or 5 years before you actually had to get your actual license. So they were closed this year almost more because the law had changed in their favor, not so much because of this incident. The Trois-Rivières Center claims to have successfully treated over 1,200 patients. However, at least in interviews, when pressed about the idea of conversion to Scientology, as Ethan was sort of mentioning, the head of the center said that they, quote, don't track what happens to most people after they leave the Trois-Rivières program. So now with addiction, getting an addict actually to stop drugs is not actually that hard. The real trick of the matter is to keep them off the drugs in the long term. Narconon is not Narc-Anon. So Narc-Onon versus Narc-Anon. Narc-Anon is an offshoot of Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, which uses a traditional 12-step program, which I have some issues with, but that's a different show.
Right.
It was started in the 1950s. It doesn't actually charge its members. And again, it's not designed so much to get people off drugs, but to keep people off drugs. Now, this is a major difference between the two NARCs. Narc-Onon is, as Ethan pointed out, actually part of Scientology's web of entities and was established in the late 60s. The treatment is actually based upon L. Ron Hubbard's, quote, The Fundamentals of Thought, a book he wrote, among other writings he had done. It was developed by a former felon, William Bendent, and was formally incorporated to Scientology in 1972. The principle behind the treatment is based on the idea that addiction is caused by fat. That is that drugs are absorbed into the fat while you're getting stoned. And that when you're not high, the drug is released back into the bloodstream by the fat, causing the craving of the drugs and thus the addiction. So their treatment or their detox is essentially sweating the drugs out. It also includes things like high doses of vitamins, lots of liquids, because if you're going to be sweating a lot, you need to replace the liquids, a balanced diet, plenty of sleep. And of course, I mean, those other things are... they're good health tips in general, and a lot of these people who are addicted quite often suffer from poor health, poor nutrition, poor sleep. Now, there are some drugs that can actually be absorbed by the fat. Opiates, in general, is one of the big ones, and barbiturates, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really the biggies. So things like cocaine, meth, PCP, they don't actually ever get absorbed from the fat. And even if they did... I mean, the fundamental idea behind this is that your addiction is caused by sort of the slow re-release of the drug into your blood system, which logically and medically, would actually have the opposite effect, because you sort of had this slow trickle in your bloodstream. It would relieve withdrawal symptoms and actually lead you to be less addicted.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, that's sort of the opposite of addiction, isn't it? I mean, that's how you get people off a lot of these drugs. Like when people get addicted to like morphine. Or what's the one that they get addicted to? Not morphine, it's...
heroin.
Heroin, and then they use morphine to get them off heroin. That's how they do it, isn't it? They slowly give you less and less amounts until you sort of wean yourself off it.
Well, yeah, no, actually, so, what they do is they will give you sort of a replacement drug. And actually, that goes into a second area that, you know, even if we say, well, the biology that they're using is ineffective, or maybe it works on people, like, who are pot smokers or something, who they're psychologically addicted, but they're not physically addicted. But for those people who are physically addicted, such as the boy who we talked about at the beginning of the story, withdrawal itself is not only painful, but is potentially fatal. When the center claimed that, you know, he was experiencing psychotic behavior, well, that's what you get with withdrawal. That's why a responsible entity like Narc Anon leaves detox to doctors and proper treatment centers where they can address these other symptoms of withdrawal.
Right.
In fact, for some forms of addiction, to stop cold turkey can actually be fatal. I mean, you literally will die from not having the drug. That is why some addictions are so hard to beat, is because it's no longer, I want to have this, it's I literally physically need to have it or I will die. That's part of the reason why... one of the things that they do to reduce the risk and withdrawal symptoms, which can last for months, is give things like methadone, which is actually a replacement drug. So it is an opiate like heroin, like you were talking before, mm-hmm. but it is a less addictive form of it. So you kind of wean yourself off.
Yeah. And that's sort of my understanding of it has always been that kind of the detox side is kind of done like in a hospital under medical supervision, because as you say, that is a more physical situation. Whereas the treatment and the sort of getting you to the point where you no longer want drugs, that's a psychological treatment. That can be done in a place, you know, like, well, not this place, obviously, but a place that this place is trying to be like.
Yeah. No, you're right. And like I say, you know, you have proper medical staff and you treat the physical symptoms of it. As I kind of mentioned before, one of the main tenets of Scientology, which is, again, this place is a part of and strongly associated with, is you don't believe in psychiatric drugs.
Right.
And one of the things a lot of withdrawal symptoms are things like anxiety, insomnia, depression, paranoia, all these sort of things, which if you had a proper sort of regiment of psychotic drugs to help you over this sort of hump, you can actually reach the point where talk therapy and all those sort of things to deal with the psychological, like the genuine mental parts of it, you know, you can actually deal with.
Right.
Now, so medically it's dubious at best and dangerous at worst. There's also the whole issue of conversion. As Ethan sort of jumped in, did the woman know this was Scientology or not? Now, Scientology, of course, claims that it does not use these centers as a venue for recruiting members. But because of the secret nature of this, quote, church, it's actually very hard to substantiate this claim. What is true is that part of the treatment is, quote, training routines, which is essentially Scientology's regular audit session, but with a slight narco twist. Now, I came across a quote from the California State Health Department's review of a Narc Anon center that was receiving federal funding in the 70s. So the state sent in a review person to take a look at their what they were doing, and they wrote a report, should we continue funding, should we not, right? And one of the things that they talked about, which I think is classic Scientology, is, and I'm quoting here, the exercise of direct eye contact tolerance, i.e. staring into the coach's eye in eyes open, is seeking for an emotional weak spot or button and a corresponding emotional response to it by bull baiting routine. The bull baiting exercise seems to involve principally physical characteristics that may be used to embarrass or humiliate an individual and condition them to accept and control the response to this verbal threat to the body image. Well, one of the mechanisms that Scientology uses to both convert and retain its converts is to destroy the sort of self-esteem. Essentially, you're brainwashing them. And these are very vulnerable people who are going to these centers, and they already have a whole plethora of issues. And you sit there, and part of the treatment is to say, Ethan, that beard, my God, how could you possibly have that ugly beard, you worthless piece of, you know, and then you've got to sit back and just say, okay, thank you. And you and the idea is to control your response. But really, you're driving them down so you can rebuild them up in Scientology's image. And not to mention, part of these sort of auditing sessions, and again with these training routines, is, you know, they record a lot of what is said, if not everything that is said. Mm-hmm. And Scientology has had a history in the past of taking these confessions and using them to blackmail people who are threatening to leave or to expose Scientology in the future.
Well, and just the thing about eye contact, that's a really interesting thing that they do, because eye contact is something very difficult for people who are going through psychological problems. I mean, I know that for certain people who have different conditions, it's very, very, very difficult for them to maintain eye contact with somebody. And to sort of force that on somebody, it's kind of like sort of psychological torture almost. I mean, the level of effort that real healthcare professionals go through to make sure that they're making somebody feel comfortable and safe so that they can go through psychological training or treatment, it's pretty extreme. And that these guys are using this as sort of a tactic really speaks volumes about their intentions. Not so much to help, but like you said, to sort of recruit their little cult.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like I say, these are such classical brainwashing type techniques. And in and of itself, is sort of horrible. But their target audience here are people, like we said before, classic symptoms of withdrawal are anxiety, paranoia, that sort of thing. To put these people through this sort of technique, it takes the whole idea of tough love to torture love.
Oh, yeah.
And again, they say it's in order to rebuild their self-esteem or what have you. But I don't see how that works by tearing them down in the first place.
Right.
Now, of course, the last thing I think we'll discuss on this, and I'm not sure if it's actually the last way that Narcanon is slimy, is this method of finding patients. I guess it's simple capitalism in one sense, is that they offer a commission for every patient that goes through treatment. Reports from insiders say that of the $30,000 treatment fee, this is normally what they get, $30,000 to $40,000 for a 3 or 4 month stint, $3,000 of that is paid to a recruiter. So even if we ignore the other parts, this seems, well slimy. To be fair, high-end treatment centers, like the Hollywood stars would go to or whatever, would pay that much in a month. But most other centers, like Narcanon is not that kind of center. It's more of your person on the street sort of center, which, of course, is obviously what this one boy was that we started with. But they charge for people who can't get public funding, and most of them get public funding, about $14,000. So it's an exorbitant sort of amount. And I noticed that in my research, every center of this sort of class makes it as one of the requirements before they will accept you is that you must be detoxed before they'll take you. So these are treatment centers to keep you off drugs, but they know that, you know, they're not designed to detoxify you. That needs to be done by a medical institution.
Right, absolutely.
This actually leads to what I think is the heartbreaking part of the whole thing, is the real tragedy of this isn't so much that Narcanon exists, although that's kind of horrible, but the reason why the mother sent her to this center, and you were asking me this earlier, Ethan, was because there's no publicly funded treatment spots open. There was no place for her literally to send her son. And this is because, again, we have funding cuts by federal, provincial governments, and people will end up not only falling through tracks, because right now her son is on the street and a drug addict, but it also leaves people vulnerable to these private institutions. Some of them may be quite reputable, but a number of them are not, and they leave them vulnerable. And the whole point of society, to create a society, is to protect everyone, and especially the weak and the infirm in it.
Absolutely. Frightening story, actually. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Radio Freethinker. So many of our listeners are probably aware of the story of Jack the Ripper, the subject of our next segment. But for those of you who are not aware, allow me to fill you in on the details. Now, before I do that, I do want to warn any listeners who are a bit squeamish or don't like to hear about serial killers, you know, feel free to fast forward a little bit.
Yes, now that you've given that warning, Ethan, we have Ms. Sarah Jane Parker in here, who will now demonstrate the Jack the Ripper technique live on air as to... No.
Let's skip the live demonstration. I mean, plus they can't see it anyway, so... Jack the Ripper is the meme name for the killer who committed the Whitechapel murders in 1888. Whitechapel, of course, is a district in London, still exists today. However, back in 1888, it was the notorious slum area that was frequented by prostitutes and sex workers. London's Metropolitan Police Service estimated that there were 1,200 prostitutes and about 62 brothels in Whitechapel. In addition, Whitechapel was also sort of a poor immigrant slum, and because it was very economically depressed... And, of course, it was 1888. Crime was common and typically unsolved.
I imagine the police didn't spend a lot of time wasting their time on these people who are probably better off dead anyhow.
Yeah, thank God we don't have that problem today.
No.
So, Whitechapel, already a bad place to be on a good day, but it got a whole lot worse once a series of grisly's murders started happening. Now, there's 11 separate murders stretching from April 3rd, 1888 to February 13th, 1891. And the Metropolitan Police Service investigated them, and they sort of came up with the collective name, the Whitechapel Murders. However, because of the frequency of violence that the prostitutes were facing in the area, it's kind of unclear how many murders can be attributed to Jack the Ripper. Five of the 11 Whitechapel murders, which have come to become known as the Canonical Five, are widely believed to be the work of the Ripper. And this is because of the particular way in which those murders took place, the level of violence that was very, very consistent, as was the treatment of the victims after they were killed. Those five kills all seem to have in common very deep throat slashes, abdominal and genital area mutilation, removal of internal organs, and progressive facial mutilations all began to be considered the distinctive features of Jack the Ripper's modus operandi.
When you say progressive facial mutilation, do you mean they were getting worse as time went on?
Yeah, exactly. So the Canonical Five include Mary Ann Nicholas, Anne Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. Nichols' body was discovered at about 3:40 a.m. on Friday 31st of August of 1888 in Bucks Row, which is now Durwood Street for people who live in Whitechapel. The throat was severely severed deeply by two cuts, and the lower part of the abdomen was ripped open by a deep, jagged wound. And then several other incisions on the abdomen were caused by the same knife.
How did they determine it was the same knife? I imagine the forensic science at this time was a bit questionable, but most investigators believe it was an accurate judgment for the time?
Well, actually, the interesting thing with the Jack the Ripper murders is that because they were so well publicized and people were, you know, they wanted these murders resolved, the police were actually pioneering a lot of new forensic techniques. So, as we'll see, a lot of what they were doing is kind of state-of-the-art for the time investigation. Now, the next victim, Chapman, her body was discovered about 6 a.m. on Saturday the 8th, September 1888, near a doorway of a backyard. Her throat was severed by two cuts, the abdomen was slashed entirely open, and it was later discovered that the uterus had been removed. At the inquest, one witness described seeing Chapman at about 5:30 a.m. with a dark-haired man of, quote, shabby, genteel appearance. Stride and Eddowes were killed in the early morning of Sunday the 30th, September 1888. Stride's body was discovered at about 1 a.m. The cause of death was one clear-cut incision, which severed the main artery on the left side of the neck. There's uncertainty about whether Stride's murder should be attributed to the Ripper or whether he was interrupted during the attack. This comes from the absence of mutilations to the abdomen. Witnesses who thought they saw Stride with the man earlier that night gave differing descriptions. Some said her companion was fair, others dark. Some said he was shabbily dressed, others well-dressed. And then Eddowes' body was found three-quarters of an hour after Stride's. The throat was severed, the abdomen was ripped open by a long, deep, jagged wound, the left kidney and a major part of the uterus had been removed. So the theory among ripperologists is that he was interrupted during his attempt to murder Stride and went off to find someone else to complete his ritual.
So, again, I know this is more detailed than Ethan has at his thing, but some questions that come to mind. I mean, one, the actual murder itself had to happen less than 45 minutes. And, I mean, there's a we're going to assume that if he is a ritualistic murderer, he would have done it not, he would not want to have done it in haste.
Mm-hmm.
And two, how far apart were these two murders? Because, I mean, if I'm almost caught outside my door, I'm going to want to make sure I'm a couple blocks away before I even think about doing something else, just so that I'm not near the frenzy of the other ones.
Well, the thing about the Ripper murders is that only one of them was committed in a private location. All the other ones were in a public place. So there's lots of speculation about, you know, was it fairly common to see a prostitute getting assaulted on the streets, and that's why nobody noticed? I mean, there's a lot of blood when you literally sever the neck to the point where you almost remove the head.
Well, maybe that actually helps explain some of it. Because, I mean, in the one sense, if you sever the neck, they're not screaming and they're not kicking or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was all, most of these were done in the dark or at dusk at least, so the growing puddle at the feet would probably have not been that noticed.
Yeah, and there actually is speculation that he actually killed the victims by strangling them and then severed the neck to let the blood out. But again, that's speculation. The final murder is Kelly's. Her mutilated body was discovered laying on a bed in a single room where she lived at 13 Miller's Court at 10:45 a.m. on Friday the 9th, November 1888. The throat had been severed down to the spine and the abdomen virtually emptied of its organs, and the heart was missing. So in addition to the Canonical Five murders, sharing all the facts about the, you know, gruesomeness, they were all perpetuated at night, on or close to a weekend. At either the end of a month or a week or so after, the mutilations became increasingly severe as the murders proceeded, except for that of Stride, who may have been interrupted. Nichols was not missing any organs. Chapman's uterus was taken. Eddowes had her uterus and kidney removed and her face mutilated. Kelly's body was eviscerated and her face hacked away, and her heart was missing from the crime scene.
Well, so, again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Is that, in one sense, there's sort of an evolving pathology here, right? I mean, it's becoming progressively worse as time goes by. But, and it's quite common for people who do serial killers to keep souvenirs of their case, but usually they tend to keep a similar souvenir. And I guess an internal body organ might qualify. I mean, maybe he's building a new woman. But you said some things that sorry, made my bells go off. So you said close to or on a weekend. So Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, well, that's 90% of the week right there. Mm-hmm. And on or close to the end of the month, well, again, that's at least 50% of the month right there. So those strike me as rather wide error bars as far as saying those are, you know, oh, we can pin them down because of this.
Yeah, and part of the reason why that was suggested is because people have speculated that perhaps Jack the Ripper had a sort of 9-to-5 type job in the daytime and committed his murders at night when he had free time, which is kind of a disturbing thought to think about in the first place. But
everyone needs a hobby.
Yeah, I guess. Well, let's go to a quick commercial break. We'll let our audience sort of de-stress after hearing all that scary stuff. And we'll talk about who was Jack the Ripper. Stay tuned.
Got to clean the studio up anyhow.
Yeah, it's all bloody.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we're discussing Jack the Ripper. And who was Jack the Ripper? Because this is the point of the topic. I recently saw an article about a new book with a dramatic conclusion about the Whitechapel murders. The perpetrator, it is claimed, was in fact a woman, none other than Lizzie Williams, wife of royal physician Sir John Williams, who was also a suspect in the murders. This new theory is quite sensational, but could it be true? So the book, entitled Jack the Ripper, The Hand of a Woman, by retired lawyer John Morris, claims the evidence is overwhelming and that it suggests the murderer is Lizzie Williams because none of the women were sexually assaulted.
So is that his only, it is obviously this person? Because he says overwhelming. So what is the overwhelming evidence he provides besides the sexual assault?
Well, he claims that personal items were laid out at the feet of Chapman in a typically feminine manner.
What is the scientific definition of a feminine manner?
I don't know.
No.
He also says three small buttons from a woman's boot were found in blood near Catherine Eddowes, and remnants of women's clothing, a cape, skirt, and hat, were found in the ashes of Mary Kelly's fireplace, and Mary had never been seen wearing them. Now, Morris also claims that Lizzie was infertile. She couldn't have children. And since all the victims were prostitutes, and three had their wombs removed, it is an indication that Lizzie had gone insane over her infertility. There's also the suggestion that Kelly was having an affair with Lizzie's husband, Sir John, and also that Sir John ran abortion clinics in Whitechapel, which might also explain why the murder stopped after Kelly was killed.
So, I mean, A, if she was inspired to do this because of an affair by her husband, why wasn't Kelly the first one to be killed? Is it true that Sir John was running an abortion clinic? Is that one of the empirical facts we have?
Well, see, the interesting thing about Sir John, I looked up why he was a suspect, and he was a more modern, in relative terms, suspect, because somebody wrote a book claiming to be a descendant of his, saying that, oh, yes, I found evidence that he was the murderer. It was examined by forensic experts, and ultimately the verdict was, this is a hoax. So I don't think we can reasonably say that Sir John was a suspect. Whether or not he ran an abortion clinic in Whitechapel, whether or not he was having an affair with Kelly, I think are probably inventions of the original hoax.
It was actually one of the ironies of the Victorian age is that, I mean, a lot of the noble men were getting a lot on the side. I mean, one of the reasons why you had 12,000 prostitutes working there is because they had work to do. I mean, it wasn't like they were there hoping that they might earn a living, but
yeah.
So it wouldn't have been uncommon for that aspect to have been true.
Right. I mean, like, other than that, like, what do you think of the evidence?
Well, again, you know, based on my limited, and I granted it's limited pathology, but if she had a fixation on fertility, again, the uterus would have been a constant thing and not a variable thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you said, what the other one took part of the kidney, right? So, I mean, again, perhaps sloppy work. I mean, that's always a potential. But the heart, I mean, that would be, I mean, that becomes a useful sort of post hoc explanation as to why the last one lost heart because it was an affair.
Mm.
But again, if she killed her because of an affair, then why wasn't she the first one to sort of die? And so there's a lot of, it looks like cherry picking of evidence.
Well, you mentioned post hoc, and that's really important because when you're trying to establish a conspiracy theory, and I'm going to call this a conspiracy theory, it's very useful to go back an anomaly hunt and assume that there was some kind of agency based on what limited facts you have. So we know Kelly had her heart removed. Oh, well, that obviously means that it was done by somebody who wanted to, you know, throw it at the feet of her cheating husband and be like, look what I've done to your mistress, right? So, I mean, I don't know. Post hoc reasoning, to me, doesn't seem to work out very often in this sort of thing.
Well, it even extends, too. I mean, the fact that someone is opening up women and taking bodily parts out, you know, this woman had her heart removed, therefore it has to be related to these ones who had their uteruses removed. I mean, it's a much closer tie, but I mean, it's still, there's a bit of cherry-picking to that, to a degree. Less mm-hmm. of a degree, but to a degree.
Well, who are the other suspects?
Not me. I wasn't there.
I'm not asking you. Virtually everyone who was alive during the times of the murders has been accused by some reader today. If we ignore the sort of wild speculation and focus on the suspects that the London's Metropolitan Police Service had, we get four. There was Kosminski, a poor Polish-Jewish resident in Whitechapel. Montagu John Darute, a 31-year-old barrister and schoolteacher who committed suicide in December 1888. Michael Ostrog, a Russian-born multi-synonymous thief and confidence trickster, believed to be 55 years old in 1888 and was detained in an asylum on several occasions. And Dr. Francis J. Tumblety, a 56-year-old American, quote, quack doctor, who was arrested in November 1888 for offenses of gross indecency and fled the country later that month, obtaining bail at a very high price.
Well, wait a minute. Where are the royals? I mean, every conspiracy theory I've ever heard about Jack the Ripper includes one of the princes.
Yeah, well, that's the wild speculation part. The interesting thing about the doctor, some have speculated that the gruesomeness of the murders would not be possible having organs removed without medical background. So, although he's a quack doctor, I don't know whether that syncs up there.
Well, I was actually listening to Skeptoid, mm-hmm. and they were talking about this, and that actually that's one of those myths that it wasn't actually well removed, that anyone could have sort of just hacked away. It wasn't surgical, other than the fact that they used a very sharp knife to open the body up.
Mm-hmm. So the first of these three suspects was nominated by Sir Melville MacNaughton, who joined the Metropolitan Police as Assistant Chief Constable, and he was second in command to the Criminal Investigation Department at Scotland Yard. Kosminski was the favored suspect by the head of the CID, Dr. Robert Anderson, and the officer in charge of the case, Chief Inspector Don Swanson. Druid appears to have been MacNaughton's preferred candidate. Well, the fact that Ostrog was arrested and incarcerated before the report was compiled leaves us skeptical as to why he was considered a viable suspect in the first place. The fourth suspect, the doctor, was stated to have been, quote, amongst the suspects at the time of the murders, and, quote, to my mind, a very likely one by the ex-head of the Special Branch of Scotland Yard in 1888, ex-detective Chief Inspector John George Littlechild. We can also note that Sir John Williams was not considered a suspect. So arguments can be made against all of them being the culprit, and there's no hard evidence that exists against any of them. So obviously the fact that the police were at no stage point where they could make a case against anyone, how likely is it that a case can be made by somebody now in the modern times?
Well, again, I mean, it's like trying to find the tomb of Jesus or, the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, perhaps the one slight difference is, I mean, it is more closer to hand. And you had mentioned that they had tried to use some more modern techniques. I think one of the ones we talked about before the show was photography, mm-hmm. which, seems to be great because there are, ironically enough, a lot of records about this particular case, even though there doesn't seem to be a lot of hard evidence, at least in the sense that we tend to think of it. There's no CIS sort of moments in this.
Yeah, although, I mean, like, it is kind of like, CSI 1888 or something, because they were trying a lot of different things. And that idea that, the police at the time, oh, whatever, the prostitutes, we don't care. But they actually seem to be pretty, hell-bent, if I can use that word, on tracking down this killer.
Well, wasn't this one of the things, the whole reason why Jack the Ripper is such a cultural meme is the fact that this was also picked up by the papers.
Oh, yeah.
And became one of those sensational stories, which
Absolutely.
Is why, maybe this even wasn't one person, but maybe several, or maybe, there's a lot of other aspects to it. But this became such an important issue because it was driven by the media press. I'm not sure if that's the best reason, but it still seemed to have been one of the reasons why it's such a cultural meme. And also one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of confusion. Again, we were talking before the show, the word Jack the Ripper, I think, was first used by someone who wrote a letter to the Metropolitan Police, and that's where that sort of term came out, and that there wasn't like they have a suspect and they think his name is Jack. It's just this was pulled really from thin air.
Oh, yeah.
Because that letter itself, I think, has been discredited strongly.
Yeah, I believe so. And the question ultimately becomes, will this case ever have resolution? And I personally don't think so. Because when you look at what the evidence actually tells us, it's not much. The facts that we have about the murders, the facts that the investigators had at the time, is really tenuous and weak. It's really unlikely that we will ever know who the real killer was. In addition, you get the fact that suspects who are accused years after the murders, I mean, they include anyone who has any kind of remote connection to the case. You mentioned the Royals. I mean, they're a huge target for this sort of thing. I don't quite understand that, but I guess...
Well, no, so the Royals had the thing. One, they were popular,
yeah.
But one of the things was this mysterious, and the conspiracy mind comes into this, right? Who had the power to suppress all the evidence? And everyone said, oh, well, the Royals obviously did.
Yeah.
But so what are some of the, you know, important points to consider with regards to this killer?
Well, one thing is that this is a very publicized case, as you mentioned. So during the time of the murders, newspapers, tabloids, gossip, and books were published and circulated, all trying to cash in on the murders and public interest. There are numerous fake letters and hoaxes that were probably invented by, like, a newspaper reporter trying to find a scoop. Given all this, it's extremely difficult to nail down what is solid evidence and what is myth. Another important fact that, like I mentioned before, contrary to opinion, the detectives working this case actually did a fairly decent job investigating. And when we look at the evidence that they presented, the evidence that we consider reliable, there's just not enough of it to make firm conclusions.
Well, I imagine another huge issue would be, because you mentioned something like buttons and all that, but this was public area, well-trodden, and the idea of preserving a crime scene would not have been something that they would have thought of that much. So I imagine a lot of the evidence that they did collect could have been contaminated one way or other, or wasn't evidence of this crime, but someone had just happened to lose a couple of buttons in the scene.
Yeah. I mean, in a place that was frequented by lots of prostitutes, it's probably not surprising to find articles of clothing here and there.
Well, and if you could murder somebody in public, I imagine a lot of roughhousing, if I can use that term, happened on a common basis.
The other thing that I think is interesting about this case is that there's not even sort of a potential suspect. We mentioned those four or five people, but it's not like, you know, the Zodiac murders where you had a suspect who was... There seemed to be, you know, a certain evidence pointing at, but was never convicted. Whereas here, there's no suspect. We don't even have anyone. We can't point anything at anybody at this point. And of course, you know, when it comes back to Lizzie Williams, I mean, the fact that her connection to the case is to her husband, who appears to be a forged connection by a modern author. It's unlikely that Lizzie Williams was connected to the murders. I mean, it is possible that Jack Cooper was a woman. I'm not saying she wasn't. Could very well be. And, you know, it's just going to be one of those, I think, enduring mysteries. What might we need to find the real killer? I think we need, like, a smoking gun. We would need some kind of document, and it would have to be linked in a way that could provide conclusive evidence. So maybe, like, we find his weapons, clothing, evidence that purports a link to his victims. Because, I mean, there have been fake Ripper diaries that have been investigated by, like, Joe Nickel and demonstrated to be false. So it's going to take quite a lot to eventually solve the crime. And don't hold your breath. My guess is that it won't be solved anytime soon.
We could always use the Wayback Machine.
The Wayback Machine?
Yes.
I mean, travel back in time to investigate. See, that seems like a frivolous use of time travel. Like, to go back in time to figure out who the killer was instead of stopping the killer. Like,
oh, yeah, well, I guess you do have a point there. But, I mean, from our perspective, it'd be much more interesting to find out. I mean, after all, society has not suffered from the loss of these people, have they?
Well,
every life is sacred, I know.
We don't know what they could have amounted to. Maybe they would have, you know, come up with a time travel device or something.
Now that would be irony.
Yes. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
win out in time.
If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.